You are now listening to WBPPR, Big Pretty Public Radio. The following program has been made possible due to contributions from Cranberry Sauce, an artificially flavored gelatinous cube we accept as food, and The Game of Solitaire. Because if you're listening to this, we assume you are alone. Also, gambling. Why work when you can win it all? Gambling. And now, an evening with the authors. I am your host, Dana Glass. Hello and welcome, loyal listeners, to this, the premiere episode of Season 3 of An Evening with the Authors. I must apologize right at the top of the show if I am not coming off as my normal professional self, as I am filled with so much joy, I am unable to contain it. This joy, of course, the source being that our original producer of the program, Bernadette, has returned to us this season. I am overjoyed to be here, back in the Big Pretty Public Radio studios, with the old gang all back together. I am, of course, referring to producer Bernadette, intern Marley, and Gustavo, the maintenance man, who is making his way to my office, and I forgot to put up a Do Not Disturb sign. Marley, if you could please intercept and tell Gustavo to leave the contents of my trash can, as I will get to them in the future, and if he has already made it into the room, please ask him to show discretion in discussing what he may have found. Of course, the entire team is not here, as our former intern and former producer, Natalie, is resting with the angels, or rejoined the cosmic dust, or whatever it is that you or she may believe happens when you no longer live in a physical body on this planet. I do not know why I brought this up. Our thoughts and prayers, yet by the look given to me by my producer Bernadette, I have made a mistake, and this should be edited out before our show is posted in podcast form on the Perfecta Podcast Network, alongside such wonderful shows as Stuart Huff's Obsessive Curiosities. No, the look I'm getting from Bernadette is we will not be editing. The show will be posted in its entirety, and that is regrettable. Perhaps it would be best to move on right into our show. Imagine your darkest days were turned into a children's television show. As the only surviving member of a teen detective group, our first author came to share with us his tale. He will now read from his memoir, My Dog Smells Ghosts, An Adolescence of Death and Mystery. This is Stevie Baker.
My name is Stevie Baker. None of you know me, but you know my life story. It's been chronicled in a certain cartoon that I'm not allowed to name due to Hanna-Barbera having an insane legal team. One you wouldn't imagine cartoons are protected by, keeping me from mentioning it, but I think you'll get the gist of it. This is from my new book, My Dog Smells Ghosts. It's really hard for me to write, but I'm glad I got it out of me. It's chapter one, My Dog Smells Ghosts. It was the summer of 1971. My stepdad, Rick, had taken me to get a puppy. The puppy was his end of an agreement that we made for me to tell everyone I wrecked my bike and in no way was pushed down the stairs after the Bears were shut out by the 49ers. You guys got to understand, stepdads weren't cool guys, you know, stepping up back in 1971. They never adopted you. They didn't post a video of it on Facebook. It's just 1971, stepdads treated you like a burden. that was just in the way of you, of them banging your mom as much as they want. Really, that's what a 1971 dad was. I named the puppy Rudy. Rudy was a purebred bloodhound. Rudy was the only puppy his mother had. Well, technically, she didn't have him. Somebody found his mom dead in a field and noticed Rudy moving around in there, so they cut him out. Well, he was special. Anyway, Rudy was pretty nervous to leave that farm, and after we picked up Rudy, we had to make a stop to see Rick's dad at a nursing home. And on the way there, Rudy took a dump in Rick's van, and that's how he got the name Rudy Doody Doo. Rick's dad was super old. He had been shot in World War I and had been in the hospital ever since. Rick's mom was a VA nurse that took care of his dad during the Depression. Rick would usually take about 20 minutes to whisper scream obscenities into his dad's ear, and that's when I decided to walk around with Rudy. Eventually, he sat next to an elderly man who was napping, and when Rudy wouldn't move, I made such a commotion trying to move him that a nurse noticed the man had passed away. This happened the next five times we visited Rick's dad, and pretty soon the paper did a story on Rudy, the dog who smells ghosts. We were contacted by a wealthy industrialist that was obsessed with ghosts. He wanted to do a documentary about me and Rudy. His name was Richard Penny Shingle. He said that he was having issues with ghosts in several places and thought we could all help each other out. My mom didn't like the idea of me hanging out with an older man with a camera, but Rick signed the paperwork anyway. Mr. Penny Shingle wanted to get a few of my friends to be in the documentary, and I told him no problem. It was no more than a moment after the words left my lips that he asked if I had no friends, and I said, "That is correct, sir. I have no friends." Mr. Penny Shingle hired three teen actors to be in the documentary with me. Their names were Garrett, Donna, and Betty. God rest their souls. This next part's from chapter 4. Our first death. We pulled up to the Blue Octopus Seafood Dinner Theater. Rudy had just shit in the van again. We were there because there had been reports that a big octopus monster was terrorizing the restaurant. Should have passed on this one. See, most of the time, the ghost or monster was always some millionaire businessman who had lost his company in a hostile takeover to Mr. Penny Shingle, and by they, I mean white men, sometimes when they panic, they turn to elaborate costuming, local lore, and usually a couple fog machines to try and save the business. Anyway, this octopus monster was right around Halloween, and I don't know what it is about Halloween, but the monster almost always turns out to be a real monster around Halloween. I don't know why. November through September, though, it's always a panicked white guy. Anyway, we cornered this real monster by the salad bar that was shaped like a dinghy. Garrett mugged for the camera and said, "Well, we better pull back the sails on this one." Not a lot of Garrett's lines made sense, but he delivered them anyway. He reached up to pull off the mask, but just squeezed the octopus monster's head. The monster grabbed him with several arms, dove through the window and into the bay. The body was never recovered. So we sat in the van wrapped in emergency blankets, coming to terms with Garrett's death. Rudy shit in the van again. After a few accidents and the loss of Garrett's replacement, Kyle, who only made it a few episodes, we were almost shut down. Mr. Penny Shingle wanted to rebrand. He said he was going to add a pug to the group, like a little buddy for Rudy. We waited in our motel for 5 days, then a delivery driver dropped off a box to us. We opened it to find a dead pug. Mr. Penny Shingle decided just to wire us the money and let us buy the pug locally. There were no pugs, so we wound up with an abused pit bull mix that found Rudy's van shits to be intimidating and ended up attacking some of the camera crew. In the summer of 1974, we were shut down. It was during our investigation of the old Vanderburg Hotel in New Transylvania, Pennsylvania. This is the case that got Donna and Betty killed. In fact, I was a suspect for most of the trial. I told them I was not there when Donna and Betty were killed. I was with Rudy in the hotel kitchen making an incredibly tall sandwich. Tall sandwich didn't sound credible to the police, but I told them that Mr. Penny Shingle was always telling me, make more sandwiches, taller sandwiches. No one could find any footage of me making the sandwiches, and it turns out that the footage was being cut, sent to Thailand, where it was repackaged and then smuggled back into the U.S. as something else that my therapist says I'm not ready to explore right now. It's all hard to explain. So this chapter is just the official log of my courtroom testimony. Chapter 5. Prosecutor, do you recognize the hallway in this security footage? Me. Yes. In the hallway from the old Vanderburg Hotel is what it's showing. Prosecutor. And why were you there that night? Me. Vampires. Prosecutor. Mr. Penny Shingle had hired you to prove that this was, in fact, the former owner of the Vanderburg Hotel posing as a vampire, correct? Me. Yes, but this was around October 5th that year, so we just assumed it was real. Prosecutor, this footage represents the last time Donna and Betty were seen alive. Can you please tell me what we are seeing here? Me. Well, that is Donna and Betty is holding a flashlight, and that is the vampire at the end of the hall there. Prosecutor. Do you have any idea what Betty could be saying in this security footage? Me. Yeah, I assume she is saying, cocksucker, motherfucker. She said it all the time. When she was surprised or confused or just excited, cocksucker, motherfucker. Can't figure out a clue? Cocksucker, motherfucker. Ghost pops out on you? Cocksucker, motherfucker. Find a dollar? Cocksucker, motherfucker. Long silence in courtroom. Prosecutor. Now, what are we seeing here? Me. They're running from and chasing the vampire. Prosecutor. Running from and chasing. Why? Me. It's just what we do sometimes. Prosecutor. And what is going on now? Me. Well, the vampire ran into the first door on the right, and Donna and Betty followed. Now, the vampire is coming out the middle door on the left side of the hallway. And here comes Donna and Betty behind them. And then we all go back in that first door again. Now, that is me and Rudy coming down the hallway with the tall sandwiches. And like we go into the last door on the left, now the vampire comes out the first door again, this time carrying Rudy and the sandwich. Then they go into the middle of the right door. Now here comes Donna and Betty and myself through the same door. Prosecutor, now can you please be very clear what happens next? Me. Yes, it looks like me, Betty, and Donna all come back out with no sign of the vampire, but we've all managed to end up switching outfits for some reason. Then we go back into that door. Now, here comes Rudy, and he drops his sandwich, but manages to repair it by shuffling all the ingredients back together like a deck of cards. Then he comes in through the door just we went into. Now we all come back out the first door and on the other side of the hallway. This is where the vampire gets frustrated and attacks Donna and Betty by dismembering them in the first room. Prosecutor. And then after that, the vampire was nowhere to be found, correct? Me. Yes. Technically, Rudy killed it. The vampire slipped in some mustard where Rudy dropped a sandwich and ended up falling directly onto an olive toothpick from the top of the sandwich. It's the last thing that ever meant anything in my entire life. Thank you.
That was Stevie Baker sharing with us a terrible, terrible tragedy he experienced, but was so entertaining for us. Sally M. has lived off the grid since December 26th, 1999, and has largely missed the technological and societal shifts since the threat of Y2K came and went. Once a formidable presence in the local poetry scene, Sally has chosen to come out of her self-imposed exile from an undisclosed location to warn society of the inevitable with her poems of the past. Here is Sally M.
Kiddos in the club chew on their technicolor binkies while Soho sticks prey on a prayer. And the cannibals lick their lips and they gnash their teeth. And this is the fledgling wildlife of the obsolete concrete jungle with its wire vines and its screens that make us scream. We need shoes. We need lipstick. We need anti-wrinkle, anti-life, anti-pore polarizers. We need lipo. We need lipo. We need lipo. Oh, and a Zippo. We are frothing with the rabies of a digital age, a virus that has been witnessed and diagnosed, but our society is too comatose. Civilization is all for naught. All is fraught. Nothing lies in the aughts. Why, oh, why to the K? We are not okay. We are far from okay. We are not fucking okay. We are frothing at the mouth, and the drool pours down our chins, and our eyes are glazed in a daze, and there remains to be seen a vaccine. Where will you be when the computers crash, when the riverbeds of cash dry up, when the contrails trail off into the silence streaked with terror, when the virus tears the birds we ride from the sky? I'll be gone. We'll all be gone. Mark my words falling on deaf ears, on doomed ears, on ears rotting, on corpses caught with their pants down, their bloated ankles. And I'll be long gone, my body prone, a seed to be sown on the new earth, cured of man's disease. And the stars will be there, as they were before, before we ripped them from the cosmos and put them in our screens and gave them golden calves for their make-believe, for their smoke screen, for their blistering, glistening, that blinded us, unable to see. Why, oh, why to the K? We're not okay. We're not fucking okay. We're fucked. And the heads on our screens agree. It says so on TV. A sea of screens as far as the eye can see. And there's one attached to every feeding tube in the hospital, the infirm gumming down, a gunning down in Compton, in Camden, in a cul-de-sac down the street. And there's one in the bar where the bar keeps keep order with their partial panaceas as seen on TV. And I'll be gone. I'm going, gone. I've gone to see beauty and beaches and trees and a cool breeze, and whatever I can take in before I'm taken in. So where will you be before the rivers boil and the sky falls? Trapped with your four walls, choking on a pair of balls, stuffing your face with fries, stuffing your head with lies, stuffing your pockets with nothing but air? And the squawking heads will tell you it's all Y2K. We are not okay. The sycophants with their sarcastic smiles will sour when they see you haven't got power. But there's power in numbers. There's power in numbers. 0110011. 0110111. 0111001.
Such misguided energy from Miss Sally M. Moving on. Chucky Chomp Chomp Watson rose to fame in the early 1980s as the adorable young star of television ads for Brick-a-Brack cereal. But his fame did not last long, and over the years, he has had to do many unspeakable things to survive. He will now speak about those things. He is the author of the new memoir, Grape Nuts of Wrath. This is Chucky Chomp Chomp Watson.
Thanks. Oops, sorry. I'm Chucky Chomp Chomp Watson. You remember? Yeah, you probably do. I was 8. I'm 40 now. So I want to thank Dana for having me out. How many people went to Comic-Con today? Thank you. How many are going tomorrow? Okay, well, if you went today or are there tomorrow, I do have a booth at Motor City Comic Con. It is 500 feet from the entrance. But stop by, and I'm signing books, I'm signing cereal boxes, and I'll do selfies, but only on my phone. All right. From my book. I was 8 years old when Kellogg's made me the spokes kid for Brick-a-Brack cereal. You guys remember Brick-a-Brack? Okay. I don't remember much about auditioning. I said a bunch of lines over and over again. And I remember one day Mom came running home to tell me I got the job. And for the next 3 years, I was super famous. Now, for those of you who spent the 80s in a coma or in your parents' genitals, my commercials were everywhere, and they all followed the same formula. I was a fat kid who didn't want to eat. Some grown up, a parent, or a teacher, or one time Muhammad Ali, who simply couldn't believe a fat kid didn't want food, would try everything they could think of to make me eat that bowl of frothy brownish cereal in front of me. "Come on, kid, it looks like chocolate," said the frustrated lifeguard on the beach. Or, "Yummy, yummy for Tubby's tummy," said the worn-down casino waitress on her smoke break. Or, in the case of Muhammad Ali, "Tastes like vanilla. What a thriller." That was my Muhammad Ali impression. You don't get that with the book. It's just typed. Eventually, and as a last resort, they all landed on "Chomp, chomp, Chucky." And as if a hypnotist had been giving me a cue, those magic words would make me hungry. "Chucky, chomp, chomp," I'd cry out like a hairless albino cookie monster. And then I'd go to town on that bowl of Brick-a-Brack like a vampire going down on a period. Nowadays, they'd call that child abuse and fat shaming. But back then, I just called it a paycheck. Sadly, my rise to fame quickly became a fall to not fame when, at 11 years old, I hit puberty. And Brick-a-Brack dropped me like a severed human head that you caught while playing football, but you were expecting to catch a football, but it's actually a severed human head. We've all been there. Soon thereafter, Brick-a-Brack introduced their now world-famous mascot, Bricky Braccoon, the Brick-a-Brack Raccoon. He's great. They weren't wrong. And my career in TV was over. I began to spiral. My parents divorced me and kept all of the money. I dropped out of middle school. I released a rap album called Serial Killer. Many years later, someone pointed out I should have spelled it like cereal, the breakfast food I was famous for. It's never crossed my mind. By the time I was 15, I was living in the automotive section of a Kmart and had a wicked addiction to nose candy, by which I mean ground up crunchberry dust. You think that stuff tears up the roof of your mouth, imagine what it does to your sinuses. The inside of my nose looked like the outside of Deadpool's. Lucky for me, the non-compete clause in my contract had just expired, and I was starting to get interest from General Mills. They were about to debut Honey Nut Cheerios, and they needed star power. And they knocked on my door. But not everyone was happy. The night before my audition, as I drifted off to sleep, there was a thud at the door. He started knocking. Let me explain. Everyone knows Snap, Crackle, and Pop, the three lovable elves that represent Rice Krispies. But what few people know is they come from a family of eight. Snap, Crackle, Pop, bang, whiz, oopsie, plop, and thud. Snap, crackle, and pop were the face. Thud was the muscle. And he was at my bedroom door. I had locked it, but it was no good. Even at 3.5 feet tall, he managed to kick the door in, hitting me across the nose, shattering what was left of my nose. I've had facial reconstruction surgery since then, 5 times. None of them worked. This is just plastic. Thud stood above me in my bed, shouting profanities like you've never heard a cartoon elf shout. And he pulled a long ceremonial dagger from his backpack. Well, I mean, he opened the backpack and then took it out. That's how backpacks work. And he stood over me chanting in ancient Celtic, I assume. I don't know what elvish. They speak elvish. I should have known that. And to find out what happens next, you got to buy my book. Please, I have a drug habit. See me after the show or visit http://www.geocities.com/book-about-chomp-chomp. Thank you.
Poor Chomp Chomp. I will never look at my beloved breakfast cereal the same again. And now to our final guest of the program. Mindy McKinley is an American author, lecturer, and activist. McKinley dropped out of college her junior year and moved to New York City, intending to pursue a career as a cabaret singer, but instead ended up opening the metaphysical coffee shop Morning Ritual. After several appearances on the Sally Jesse Raphael show, she became renowned in self-help circles. She has written 13 books, including 4 New York Times number one bestsellers in the Advice, How-To, and Miscellaneous category. Now she will read from her new book, 40 Lessons from 40 Men, How to Continue Your Growth After You've Realized You'll Be Dating Forever and You're Not Even Lonely Even. This is Mindy McKinley.
Hi, I'm Mindy McKinley. This is my latest book, 40 Lessons from 40 Men, How to Continue Your Growth After You've Realized You'll Be Dating Forever and You're Not Even Lonely Even. Chapter 3 is on gratitude. Mark is sitting crisscross applesauce in his Papasan chair, his prize chair, and his only non-milk crate furniture. The blue-green glow of the lava lamp glazes over the right side of his face. His startlingly lopsided ball sack melts off the edge of his seat like a Salvador Dali clock. His disproportionately round abdomen is obstructed by his guitar with only 5 strings. He scratches out some series of sounds reminiscent of glycerine. Is that Bush? I wonder silently. I don't ask him. He'd be too proud. It is Bush, I think. Only it's not 1994. I wish it were. I miss it. If it were 1994, Gavin Rosdell would still be a catch, and I'd still be clutching tightly onto my virginity like Gollum and his precious. And I wouldn't already know how this night is going to end. To be clear, I don't miss my virginity. I just miss being an insufferable bitch about it and lording it over people for fun. Mark continues to strum the guitar. He looks away and pretends to be casual, as if he'd be doing this regardless of my presence or the presence of any human female person. It's that magical point in the evening now. I either have to leave right now, or spend the next 10 minutes in a cycle of being jackhammered into the wall behind his headboardless bed and watching him try to pinch and stuff his half-flaccid penis back inside me like he's trying to put the toothpaste back into the tube. Like he's trying to keep a wet dog in a bathtub. He doesn't come. I'm grateful. Instead, he just tires himself out from poor cardiovascular health. Then goes completely soft. Then vaguely blames me. This like never happens. Like never. I'm sure it doesn't, Mark. I'm sure it doesn't. I quietly pick his dog's hair out of my mouth. Am I tired enough to stay? A cuddle would be nice. A late night chat in the dark, perhaps. His arm doubles in weight across my sternum. He begins to snore directly into my ear canal. I'm stuck on the side of the bed that's pushed up against the wall. There's space for it not to be. It just is. He's on the other side of me, pressing me into the bed with his dead-weighted limbs. The dog is on top of the blanket, resting between my legs. I am completely immobile, thirsty, and wide awake. I feel truly safe. This must be what it's like to have a family, I think. I try to crawl over him and get some air and some water. I can't tell which glasses are clean, so I drink directly from the tap. I put my shoes on to go to the bathroom because I'm not sure whose hair is all around the toilet, but the lighting is too bad to inspect it right now. I pull back the shower curtain out of curiosity. A full-size carton of Breyers mint chocolate chip ice cream is sitting on the edge of the tub. No lid. Spoon inside. Completely melted. What happened here? I wonder, was he having a bath and dessert? Was he eating and shitting? How did he forget the entire carton? How long has it been sitting here? Oh God, how long has it been since he took a shower? I stroll through the apartment freely in the dark. He doesn't have a roommate. I'm truly moving up in this world. I lay back down in my corner. I'd like to take a second to remind you that I am Mindy McKinley. Best-selling author and not beloved comedian Mandy McKelvey. I lay back down in my corner and I attempt to sleep again. He rouses. Where'd you go? To the bathroom. Where else would I fucking go? He flings his arm over my chest again and goes immediately back to sleep. Mark begins to exhale deeply through his mouth, a deep, deep exhale that I've never been able to relax enough to experience in my life. It comes from deep down in the bottom of his lungs. It smells like pot. I guess that's probably pot. And flaming hot Cheetos, I guess. And something sour. Is that ranch? Or is it the beginnings of that inevitable abscess that will eventually cost him $4,000 in dental surgery? He doesn't have the insurance. It's $18 a month. Jesus, babe. I imagine him saying to me. He's right, though. these things add up. And he's an artist, I think. And a bartender. And he has to make the hard financial choices, I think. Lying in the dark, I think. Quietly, while the WWE Network debits $9.99 from his account. I tell myself, but he needs this. It's almost time for SummerSlam. I think it best I go back to sleep. I hum softly to myself like a lullaby. Don't let the days go by. Glycerine. Thank you.
Loyal listeners, that will conclude our first episode of Season 3 of An Evening with the Authors. I'd like to thank all of the authors who were guests on this episode. I'd also like to thank the venues which have hosted the live shows you heard in these recordings. The White Rabbit Cabaret in Indianapolis, Indiana. Sellerman's in Hazel Park, Michigan. And Kaiju in Louisville, Kentucky. I'd like to thank Eric Salazar, who wrote, recorded, and composed our intro music entitled Soul Search. I'd like to thank my producer Bernadette. I'd like to thank intern Marley for not judging me for what she saw in my office. But most of all, I'd like to thank you, loyal listeners, for spending an evening with the authors. I'm Dana Glass. Good night.